I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special U.S. Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius XM satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces Radio Network. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk with linebacker Daryl Talley about his 14-year NFL career and his four trips to the Super Bowl. Also, we'll remember John Wooden, a man who was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame not once, but twice, and who many call the greatest coach ever. And Adonal Foyle will join us. Foyle's life is a story of determination as he grew up on a small Caribbean island and became an NBA first-round pick who had a 13-year career. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Daryl Talley. Talley is the epitome of an NFL linebacker, a chiseled body, determination, and a drive to be the best. A product of West Virginia University, Talley was drafted in the second round by the Buffalo Bills. He spent 12 seasons with the Bills during their glory years. Under Marv Levy, Talley and the Bills went to four consecutive Super Bowls, but each time came up short. Talley is philosophical about the experience, saying, "I was fortunate to have four bites of the apple, even though I didn't eat the whole thing." Talley is a true Midwesterner, having grown up in Cleveland. I asked him how much of Cleveland rubbed off on him in the way he played football and as a person.
It's all of it. That's me. That's the way it is. That's the way the majority of the people are in my area. I mean, everybody believes in going to work, doing their job for a fair day's pay. And if you don't do that, then everybody frowns on you going, "Wait a minute, what do you think you are? You think you're something special? You don't have to work?" Everybody's got to work. Everybody's got to put their nose to the grindstone and keep it there if you want to be successful in this world.
You also grew up in a family in which you had a mother and a father that gave input to you. You have a brother, right?
Oh, yes. Brother? Yes, yeah. I did. And believe me, my parents stayed on the two of us because I think if they hadn't stayed on us, we wouldn't know where we would be at right now. But we were kind of mischievous as kids, me and my brother.
What was the neighborhood like?
Neighborhood was it's like you would see one of those old-fashioned neighborhoods where if you messed up in a neighborhood, if you messed up down the street, you got your butt beat down the street. Then when you were on your way home crying from getting your butt beat by one of the neighbors, then you got home, the neighbor then called your mom. Your mom got you when you got in the door, and you got another whooping. So I'm like, you know what? It didn't do you any good to do anything wrong around here. You're going to get trouble anywhere you go.
I remember Jackie Joyner Kersey telling me she grew up over in East St. Louis, across the river from St. Louis, and she said, "We never stood a chance of going wrong because we weren't afraid of the police. We were more afraid of mom and dad."
You're afraid of getting your butt beat when you got home. Trust me, fear is something. Fear, it'll drive you nuts. I mean, you're actually sitting there going, "Oh, my God, I can't wait to. I hope he comes in and is in a nice mood. Hope my dad's not mad today."
Mm-hmm. What'd your dad do?
My dad was a sawmaster in the foundry in Cleveland.
And your mom?
Mom worked in a Colonial woolen mill. She worked in a woolen mill, putting yarn on bobbins and stuff like that.
What were the pressures that you faced as a kid? Because we hear about what kids have to deal with today.
The pressures I faced as a kid, I really didn't have too many pressures because it's like they say, didn't have a whole lot of things when I was young, but what we did had, my parents made sure you knew how to take care of what you had. It had to be washed, cleaned, and pressed. You just took care of your stuff. You didn't just throw it on the ground like you see kids today. They would just throw stuff on the ground. My kids now, I yell at them every day for it. They just throw stuff on the ground and think, "Oh, well, Dad will come by and pick it up."
Was it a mixed neighborhood that you lived in?
For the most part, no. We were the second black family to move into my neighborhood. And the funny part about it is we were the second black family to move into my neighborhood. And 5 years down the road, maybe seven, when I got to high school, I went to a 98.8% all black high school. And when I moved in the neighborhood, we were the second black family in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Where did sports come into your life? What time?
Sports came into my life really actually kind of funny because my old man looked at me and says, "You want to play football, son? Want to play baseball?" I played baseball. And he said, "You want to play football?" I said, looked at him. I thought about it. I said, "Pop, I'll play football if you play football." My dad said, "Okay." My dad went out and played on a semi-pro football team. He was a kicker. He kicked in high school. So he kicked, and he was a middle linebacker. But on the semi-pro team, all he did was kick. And he said he was going to go kick. I said, "If he can kick, I can play." And my first time playing on the field was really, really funny. Short story, I'm out there playing the game. My dad, everybody else has got a uniform on. The guy tells my dad what color the jerseys are and everything, what color the pants are. Well, you seen the way the Buffalo Bills jerseys look right now?
Yeah.
Well, that's the kind of jersey my dad bought me. He took and bought those iron-on letters, numbers, and put them on, put my name on the back of the shirt for me. But everybody else's shirt was blue. My shirt was gold with blue balls on the top of the shoulders. And everybody said, well, Daryl, didn't you feel out of place with your shirt on like that? And everybody else had a different color shirt? I said, no. Because my shirt was clean and my shirt was new. I didn't care what they had on. Guy put me in the game. First play I go in the game, I'm standing there, it's a muddy field. I put my hand on the ground, play snap, guy goes by me, I look. I'm not getting dirty. My mom and they're yelling at me. I'm not getting my clothes dirty. Came in halftime. Coach looked at me, he says, son, I was playing defensive tackle, and I'm the cleanest person on the field. He says, son, this game's not for prima donnas. If you're going to play football, you got to get down in the dirt and get dirt on your knees and your hands and everywhere. So I looked at him. I looked at my old man. My old man stood there, shook his head. So I went back out the second half. I came off the field. My mother told me I couldn't get in the car. I was covered in mud from the top of my helmet to my toes, covered. There was nothing you could see. And the uniforms were gold pants, blue shirts, which mine was yellow, and everything was just mud. And my mother just said, look, just take off everything you got on right now. We'll put it in the trunk of the car, and you'll go home. I went home in my underwear and T-shirt because my mother refused to let me get in the back seat of the car.
Were you a Cleveland Browns fan growing up then?
No, I actually wasn't. I actually wasn't a Cleveland Browns fan. I wasn't a real big fan of football. I mean, I watched it. I got to go to a game every now and then. Didn't really have a favorite team. I like certain players. And then everybody knows me that the Stork was one of my idols and Ted Hendricks and Jack Tatum were two of my idols because I love the way Tatum hit people. And plus he went to Ohio State. And I loved Ted Hendricks for the things that he did on the field. I mean, here's a guy that's 6'7", that can block passes, cover running backs, rush the quarterback, block punts, field goals. He could do just about anything he wanted to on the field. And, you know, I said, that's the kind of player I want to be. I want to be able to do everything that I can do on the field. Well, I got to the point to where I could block punts, block passes, cover running backs coming out of the backfield, and tackle people, and have a lot of fun at it. So, you know, I looked at it and said, it's a good idea. But the thing that I really loved was watching Tatum run through people. I used to watch him and George Atkinson hit people, and I used to sit there and go, yep. I need me some skull and crossbones just so I can hit somebody like that.
I had Tatum and Atkinson in the studio here one night, just where you were sitting. And Fox called, the former player for the New England Patriots.
Yeah.
And he called, and we were laughing and talking. And I said, wait a minute, what did you learn most from these two guys? He said,
how to duck.
Not how to duck, and also how to grab somebody from behind, pull them down, and not get a penalty.
You would have to duck real quick with the two of them.
It really was. When did football get serious to you? And what I mean serious is when did you think, hey, wait a minute, maybe I can do something with this, get an education, and maybe even have a pro career?
Now, this is going to be really funny. I only played 10 games in high school, 10 varsity games. I played 7 my junior year because I broke my hand fighting. I played 3 my senior year because I broke my ankle. And we played against the number 2, 3, and 5 team in the state. And I made just about every tackle on the field, but 2 and 2 of the games. And the other one, I made 18 tackles in it. And the coach came up to me and he says, son, where have you been? I said, I've been sitting on the sideline. I had a broke ankle. You just got off a broke ankle and you run like that? I said, yeah. And that led me to get a scholarship to school because I had written everybody. I wrote Ohio State, Michigan State. Michigan, everybody trying to get myself a scholarship to school or get somebody to take a look at me because I didn't think anybody would. And long story short, none of those guys came calling. Only people called me was Syracuse, West Virginia, Iowa and Iowa State. And I said, Iowa and Iowa State is just too far away from home for me to go. I like to stay close to my mom and dad so I can see them and talk to them. Well, I could have done that on the phone, but they couldn't come see me play. Really never thought about playing professional football. Never, not one time.
Did you see going to college as an opportunity merely to get an education then?
Just to get an education, to do something I enjoyed doing. I looked at it, I could get an education and do something I enjoyed doing. And going into my senior year in high school, in college, you know, I'd made all East and everything else, but I never really gave two shakes up about it. You know, everybody's like, he doesn't even get it. And it came down to a game I played in Pittsburgh where I was the Sports Illustrated Player of the Week, and I had a pretty good game. I blocked the punt, scored, picked the ball up, scored, and made 50, had 15 tackles. Guy looked at me. He says, you know you're going to get drafted, right? I looked at him. I said, I thought they ended the draft. I'm not going to the Army. He said, no, dummy, in the NFL. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not worried about it. Well, if I get drafted, I get drafted. But I didn't think I was getting drafted. And he looked at me. He says, are you kidding me? You really don't think so? I said, no. Had no idea. Didn't even think about it.
Daryl Talley has joined us here on Sports Byline, the former linebacker in the NFL, most of those years in a Buffalo Bills uniform. We were talking about West Virginia. You were a kid that came out of the city in Cleveland, but you end up on a mountaintop. You know where I'm going with
this. I know.
What was that like for you? Was that a culture shock?
It is a real big culture shock. I mean, you go from being in the city to being in the mountains, or what I called it was Morgan Hole, because Morgantown's actually sitting down in a hole between mountains. And when I got there, the people were friendly and everything, and I had a great visit. I enjoyed my host, and I enjoyed the place there. I thought I would have fun at school there. But, boy, was I in for a rude awakening. There was no radio stations. There was only a McDonald's there. There wasn't anything else. Then they brought in a Hardee's. I mean, I went back after I got elected into their Football Hall of Fame, or into the school's Hall of Fame there, and to see the things and the way that town's grown, they got martini bars in college. I didn't know they existed. We had quarter beer night, nickel beer night. That was big for us. And, I mean, just looking at some of the things that have gone on in that town is unbelievable.
I had the same experience because my grandparents lived in Parkersburg, West Virginia. Now picture this for a second. My dad was in the military, and so we lived in places like Germany, Paris, London.
Might be nice.
And for 9 months of the year, that's where I lived. For the 3 months in the summer, I went to Parkersburg, West Virginia.
Ooh.
You talk about culture.
Paris?
Stuff. Yeah.
From Paris to Parkersburg? To Parkersburg? Nah, I don't think there was a whole lot that... The food had to be completely different.
Well, it was, but the people were really, really wonderful, and that's what I came away with more than anything else. But for you, a young man that comes out of a city environment, and also being an African-American going there, what was that like?
It was a bit of a culture shock because the school was perhaps, I want to say, 95% all white school because it's a private school.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sitting there going, wow. Why did I come to school here? And you look around, you have a good time, you see people there. I think it just gave me a different outlook on life as to what people in other parts of the country live like. And I think that interested me more than anything else because I got to find out what a guy from West Virginia was like. I met one of my good friends, his name's Mike Dawson. Mike Dawson had never seen a black person before. He thought black people had tails. He walked up to me, and he's looking at me, and a buddy of mine, Calvin Turner, was there at the same time. He looked at me, and he's going, I said, Calvin, what's wrong with him? What's wrong with this boy, man? I'm going to have to take him out. Now, mind you, Mike Dawson is a curly-haired blonde guy, blue eyes, huge guy. He's a linebacker. He's just walking around, get behind. Man, what's wrong with you? And Calvin said, man, he think we got tails. I said, no, man, I don't have a tail. See, I pulled my pants down. I said, see, I don't have a tail hanging out. It's not tucked up and rolled in my underwear or anything. And me and him became great friends. He yelled at me one year. We're playing Penn State. We had a chance to beat Penn State at West Virginia, which would have been a first because we never beat them. He blocks the punt, and in the process of blocking the punt, he falls and tears up his knee. I'm the guy that's supposed to come in and scrape up the ball if he blocked it. So I get in there. I fumbled the ball out of the end zone. He wanted to know if I got the touchdown. I told him, no, Mike, I didn't get the touchdown. I got a safety. He read me the riot act screaming. And the coach is looking at him like, why is he screaming at you about the ball not being a touchdown and you kicking it out of bounds? I said, I don't know. He just tore up his knee. I want to see how he feels. He didn't want no parts of it. He wanted the touchdown. So that right there in itself started to instill in me, no matter what happens, you play the game as hard as you can and try and score every time you can.
Let me fast forward for just a second. The class of 83 that came into the NFL, probably, and I think most people would agree, the greatest class. I mean, there was Dan Marino, there was John Elway, there was Jim Kelly, there were others like that. What was draft day like for you?
Draft day for me was torture because I graded out in the combines as the fifth best player in the draft, supposedly. And came time for draft day came around, and because I told them I had a pinched nerve in my neck and shoulder, I'd never missed a game or anything, and the draft was so rich, I slipped from possibly the fifth pick, which San Diego took Billy Ray Smith in that spot. There was no other linebacker taken in the first round that year, except for him, and went to the second round. And I just looked at it, and I said, okay, fine. This is the way it's going to be. Then it's going to be a fight. We're going to fight every day I'm there. So they're going to know I'm there the whole time I'm in the league, because I'm going to make sure that they know I'm there and they're not going to skip over me again. Well, they did it again when it came around time to vote for the Pro Bowl. They skipped right over me. For years they did that to me. So, you know, it's always been an uphill fight for me.
How did you feel about being drafted by Buffalo?
I didn't mind. You know, I thought Buffalo was here's how bad my geography was when it came to figuring out where Buffalo was. I thought Buffalo was right outside of Manhattan. And I'm growing up in Cleveland, and it's only 2.5 hours away from me. So I'm going, oh, I can go to the city every week. I'm going to like this. I get to Buffalo. New York City is 6 hours away. I'm going, 6 hours? That's a long drive. But the good thing about that, they had People's Express, which used to fly us from Buffalo to New York for $49.
Right.
So that was the only thing. Going there didn't bother me about the weather, because the weather's just like it is in Cleveland. It may be 10 degrees colder, but it's 10 degrees warmer in Cleveland in the summer. That's it.
When you take a look back on it, Darryl, was the Buffalo franchise and Daryl Talley a marriage made in heaven? Because I always sensed there was such a comfort factor for you, just the environment, the coaches you had, the players you had around you.
Well, that became that way, but at the beginning it wasn't.
Not at the beginning.
At the beginning, I was a 2-14, 4-12, and 4-12. So I heard all of the knock-knock jokes there were, and it just became the idea that, you know what? There were a nucleus of us that were there that were really young and said, forget it. We're not going to take it anymore. The comment that comes to mind the most was Jim Kelly came to me and he said, okay, DT, it's our team now. We're the guys that's got to run this. It's our squad. Let us do it as a team. And that right there said, okay, we're going to do everything as one. So if one of us went out, all of us went out. It didn't matter whether it was Jim versus the third team snapper. If you were going to go out, hey, what are you doing tonight? Well, come on, go with me. Just grab a – it didn't matter who it was. You just never went out by yourself. So everybody sort of bonded together and stayed there, stayed together with each other and sort of took care of each other. And the people of Buffalo are really great, generous people. I mean, they're opening their hearts up to you as long as you're willing to go out there and work. If you're going to work for them, they'll appreciate you, and they'll show you they appreciate you.
Yeah, I saw a lot of similarities between Buffalo and Cleveland in the blue-collar kind of atmosphere. Buffalo, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, that kind of triangle right there.
That's what I used to tell them. I said, look, I'm going to bring my lunch bucket, and I'm going to work. Because that's the only way you could do it, because if you did it any other way, you're going to feel like you're slighting somebody or you're cheating somebody, and that's one thing that my old man wouldn't go for. You ain't going to cheat anybody at anything. You're going to do it upright.
Where did the turning point come? What was the game? What was the moment where that 2-14, 4-12, where did it turn for the Buffalo Bills and that team?
For me, when I realized it was 1987. Was it 87? 87, we were playing Philadelphia. We were playing the Eagles. It was the last game of the year, and I just so happened to look around the locker room. And I was sitting there, and I was talking to Cornelius. We were out there playing and playing exceptionally well, just beating the Eagles up. And I looked at him. I said, man, you know what? This is after the game. I said, we got a chance. We got a chance to be really, really good, man. I think we're going to blow some people away. And I said, all we got to do is stick together. We can do it. Because goes back to the same thing one of my Pee Wee coaches told me. He said, a chain's only as strong as his weakest link. And I said, I want me to be the weakest link because I know I'm not going to break. I said, everybody else might break, but I know I won't break. And Cornelius looked at me. I said, man, look, we have you, me, Shane, Bruce, Leonard Smith, and I think 88 we added Thurman Thomas to the mix. And after that, on defense, we in an offense we had had Jim and Andre and stuff like that. So we were pretty well set, but we were real young. And young, crazy, and energetic. And we just felt that we could do it. We didn't care what the odds were we were fighting. We fought the uphill battle all the time.
Did the leadership come naturally and easily to you?
For me, yeah. Because it was one of those things where Bill Polian came up to me and he said, okay, I tell you what I need. I need a leader. I need somebody that's going to be a leader for this team. And one of y'all got to step up and do it. I went, well, somebody's got to take the bull by the horns. I don't mind doing it. Because what are you going to do? You going to fight me? Beat me up? Let's go ahead. Come on, let's go try it. And I said, okay, I'll do it. Didn't bother me.
Yeah, the one thing you and I talked about was that with the great players, they're not afraid to fail, are they?
No. See, that's the thing. Only thing I can't get it right. The beats a failure is a good try. That's the only thing that beats a failure.
Darryl, let's talk a little bit about the first time you saw or met Marv Levy. I'm just wondering what your impression was of him.
Very funny. I looked at him. I went, little bitty man, long arms. Then after he started speaking, I was like, oh, my God. We better just sit down and buckle him up here, buddy. This is going to be a long one. I mean, Marv's a great guy. I love him to death. He's a very intelligent guy, probably one of the smartest people I've ever met. And to sit down and listen to him, you'd be sitting there trying to go, wow, what else could I get out of you? But it was, I don't know other way to say it other than he's a great man, and I appreciate everything I got out of him.
Certainly a Hall of Fame coach, deservedly so. And I would think that, and maybe it was because he coached the Buffalo Bills in Buffalo. It was Buffalo, and it wasn't New York. It wasn't Los Angeles or Chicago, because the dynamics of those markets are different. And it was also a different time where you had athletes that were willing to listen to the coach and do what he said. Whereas today, there's always the questioning, well, if I do this, I got to check with my agent. Maybe I'll hurt myself. Maybe, you know, all of those things. Why was he so successful?
I think because Marv allowed his players to play, and he allowed his assistant coaches to coach. He didn't get his hands in everything. He didn't come over and say, look, I need to help the running backs do this. I need to help the linebackers do that. He didn't do any of that. He wanted to do two things. One thing, really, that was control, manage the clock, and run short yardage and goal line. That was his pet peeves, those three things. And he did that, and he let you know right away, hey, we're not going to have any crap out of you on this. This is what we need to do. It needs to be done to the letter. And he would just sit there and say, go ahead. He'd laugh and joke with you. And he had a unique ability to be able to tell you about your family. He would walk up to you. He would know your kids' names, your wife's name, your parents' names, everybody. And it would amaze me that he had only been around probably a month, and he knew everybody's wife's, kids' names, everything. And you just sat there and waited. It was like, what's he going to say next? He was just one of the most interesting guys I've ever had to talk to.
And one of the other things about him, I understood, and I've talked to him about this, that he always liked war strategy. He was like, Woody Hayes, you're putting your head down. Bill Walsh, Woody Hayes, and Marv Levy. And Winston Churchill was
Churchill was huge.
Yeah.
He would tell you, I mean, I learned more about history from him than I did in school. I mean, every time you go out, before you go there, and he didn't like Rommel too well either. But he would come up with things, and you're sitting there going, what? Thurman, I'd ask him, could you break it down to layman's terms? And then he says, oh, for you, Thurman, it means this. He'd always get Thurman with that. But he was truly, truly an innovator in the way he communicated. He's a great communicator is what I should say.
Yeah. What was his pregame and maybe halftime speeches, and even post-game speeches, win or lose like? Because I get the feeling that maybe he was a great orator.
they weren't really rah-rah speeches. You had to sit there and you had to think about what he said. When you think about what he's saying, then you go, oh, I got it. And then if you didn't get it, you'd ask the guy next to you, did you get what he was talking about? And then it finally got around to where everybody was paying attention to him because you were afraid you were going to miss something. And every time he opened his mouth, something was coming out.
What did he say both at halftime and also say on the sideline in the second half in a Houston game where you guys were down so far? What was that, 35-3? I think you ultimately were in the hole before you came came back from that one.
He really didn't say a whole lot going into the locker room. He didn't say a lot. He just said, we got to get this done and that. I was the one that did it. I was the one that was standing up in the locker room. Tears in my eyes, I told him, if you quit, you effing quit on me, I will kill you. We're going to go back out here and we're going to fight. If they play next week, they're going to play next week and they're all going to be sore. They're going to lose next week if they play. I said, we're going to go out here and hit any and everybody there is moving. And then I went downstairs into my defensive meeting. Walt Corey read us the Riot Act, who really never, ever got upset at anything we did. He just said, okay, whatever. Well, Walt got mad. He was like, who are you guys? I don't know. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. We must have really did something wrong for Walt to be getting on us. So he asked us, what did we want to play? He asked me and Mark Kelso, and I said, we want to play the nickel package with 3-4 personnel. He thought I was crazy, but he said, if that's what you want to play, more than happy to put you in it. Go for it. He put 4 linebackers on the field against 4 wide receivers. And what I told the linebackers, I said, look, here's what we're going to do. We are going to beat the snot out of them. I said a couple other words in between, but I told them that's exactly what we're going to do. We're just going to get physical and beat on them. I don't care where they're at. Beat on them. And that's what we proceeded to do. And by the, third quarter, the game is, I looked up at the scoreboard. I said, you know what? We're only 7 points down. This is the third quarter. We had a whole nother quarter.
And you came back and won that game and then in overtime. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was funny, though, because coming out after halftime, we go out. Our offense has got the ball. They're driving. Frank Reich throws an interception. Chris Dishman runs it back to the end zone. Eddie Abramowski looked at me, because here's what I said. I said, don't worry about it. We got them right where we want them at. We got them right where we want them at. Now let's go, boys. Let's get out here and get the beating. And he looked at me, and he thought I was absolutely nuts. My teammates, Mark Pike, told me afterwards, he said, I thought you were crazy in the locker room. I said, no, that's just the way I felt and what I believed. And I said, if y'all were going to quit, we were going to fight.
Greatest comeback ever by an NFL team. Bruce Smith was somebody that you took underneath your wing. And really, I think most people would say if it were not for Daryl Talley, Bruce Smith would not have had the great career that he had. And he once said of you, Daryl, I know he will always be back there in position to back me up. If I'm unable to make the play without Daryl Talley, I wouldn't be half as good a player as I am with him on my team.
That's a great comment coming from him, a great compliment from me. But Bruce and I, we're truly good friends, and I seen something in him that I didn't have. I mean, he's an imposing force, and if to put him on a running back or put him on a smaller man was my object, to just so that I could have fun and watch and laugh. I mean, I've watched him grab 300-pound linemen and throw them around, and I used to tell him all the time, I said, man, look, just go get him. I don't care how you get him, just get him. And I would do things that most people wouldn't do. A lot of guys would say, I'm not going to go in there and take 2 guys on so he can run free. Well, for me, it was all about sacrifice. Somebody had to sacrifice something in order for you to win. I mean, not everybody can get all the glory. Somebody's got to do the dirty work. And I just sort of, being the older guy, I said, I'll take on that responsibility. I'll go out and do the dirty work. I'll do the things that nobody else wants to do. Everybody wants to rush the passer. Okay, fine. I'm not going to be allowed to rush the passer. Cornelius is a better pass rusher than I am. Let him rush the passer. I'll cover the running back. So what I did, I looked at the situation and said, where best can Daryl Talley help this football team?
On and off the field, Daryl Talley stayed true to his Midwest roots. Now on to basketball. This year, we lost a giant of the game. At 99, Coach John Wooden passed away. He accomplished unparalleled success as not only a coach, but as a player as well. He's one of only three people to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame twice as a player and a coach. He was an All-American player at Purdue, where he was college basketball's Player of the Year. And at UCLA, he coached the Bruins to 10 NCAA championships, including 7 in a row. Beloved by his players and respected by all, he touched many people's lives on and off the court. I talked with Coach Wooden many times on Sports Byline, and in our last conversation, I asked him, is the way the game is played today compatible with John Wooden?
Well, my philosophy wouldn't change if I were coaching today any more than making the normal changes according to the rules with the advent of the clock and the three-point rule. You do things, of course, to take advantage of those particular situations, but otherwise my philosophy would not change.
What about all the things around college basketball, the pressures? Have they changed a great deal, and would that be something you'd be comfortable with, Coach?
Problems are problems. They change, but you always have them. And if you can't cope with the problems that exist, then you should be in something else. But if you're in something else, you'd find that there were problems there, too. I think pressure is what you put on yourself, and if you don't put pressure on yourself, you're going to lose your job.
Recruiting has always been a key part to the success of almost any college sport. How did you approach it when you were coaching at UCLA?
I wanted youngsters to want to come. I refused to initiate contact with any out-of-state students, and I seldom visited the homes. I didn't believe in that. I didn't want to talk youngsters into coming. I wanted them to know what we had to offer and for them to want to come. I liked to have them come and visit our campus and see what we had and talk with them and talk with the players that you had so they could get an evaluation from them. But I didn't want to talk them into coming, and I think any player who played for me would tell you that I didn't talk him into coming. I would tell him that if he did come, we wanted him or I wouldn't be recruiting him, but if he did come, there'd probably be times in the first year or so that he probably would think he should have gone someplace else. But in all probability, had he gone someplace else, he'd be thinking the same thing. But after a while, that would all straighten out. That was my philosophy, and I tried to stick to it.
One of your former coaching pupils, Denny Crum, was with us, John, and he was lamenting all the things that you have to do now when you walk into a home of an 18-year-old. You almost have to tell him first thing how many times you're on television. He kind of shook his head, and as we talked about it, he says, you know, it just was not that way at one time, and he said, I think it was a better time for college sports.
Well, you've got to recognize that times change, and you have to go along with them and make certain changes along with them, but essentially it remains the same. You have to get them to believe in you, trust you, and if you're honest with them, that can come about. If you give them a line of goods, even though you may get one youngster, that news will get around and you'll lose the next one. So you've got to be honest about it and give them an honest picture of everything. And if you try to paint it too rosy, I think you're painting yourself in a corner.
I know that with all the success that you have, when you have a successful program, that in a sense is an endorsement for what you're doing. But now a lot of kids want to go on and make the big money that's in the NBA because they believe that everybody's going to make it to the NBA. Is that something that coaches have to deal with today and really try to get the kids to focus on maybe the broader approach, the fact that they need an education to go along with their athletic talents?
That's no different from what they should always have been doing. You know, always, at all times, you must make it clear to your players that they're there, first of all, to get an education. And basketball or football or the sport may be paying for it through the scholarship, but their main purpose must always be the education. No matter how good they are, a small percentage are going to make it in the pros, and a small percentage of those who make it are going to be the stars who are going to have a long career. And yet their education is a long career. That's going to last them all their life. And if they can get a foundation to establish a meaningful life in society as a whole with the education. They can't do it just with sports.
John, it was either your way or no way in a sense because you were a disciplinarian, but when you brought in certain players into your program, did you find that there were some that really tried to buck you for a while, and how did you turn them around, or was it that it was my way or no way?
Well, a coach has the greatest ally in the world if he'll use it, but I've found that many, many coaches are afraid to use it. The bench. They all like to play, and I could name a player that's probably the best player in his position that I had that sat on the bench almost a year until he learned that it must be a team game and it's not an individual game, and I was not interested in individual statistics. I was interested in the statistics for the team as a whole. But you can't be afraid to use it. I don't think you should bind yourself with a whole lot of rules, but when you do have a rule, you have to stick to it, no matter what individual might be involved or what his importance on the team seems to be. Every player on the team must be given the feeling that there is a place for him, there's a role for him to play. Some might be the engine in a car, and some might be just a nut holding a wheel in place. But each part is essential, and that's something that I always tried to get across to the youngsters, that many of their parts would not be in the public eye, but I would know about them, and they'd be very, very, very valuable.
Did you also find that by having that type of approach and philosophy, John, that it also helped in endorsing the team concept, where you did not have anybody who felt they were more important than any other element of the quintet on the floor?
Very definitely. And I was concerned about that from the very beginning with all the players, and stressed the fact that it was a team game, and then no player is any bigger than the team, and it's, I'm interested in their individual abilities, but how that can contribute to the team as a whole. And I tried to make that clear, and with some it was no problem, and with others it was more of a problem. I was fortunate in some of the superstars that I had, they had that concept immediately. There was no problem at all. And if a star or a superstar has that type of attitude, it makes it rather imperative that the others have it too.
I find it rather interesting to hear coaches kind of talk about the fact that they have to deal with a lot of elements that they didn't have to deal with before. Most are namely something that maybe an athlete comes from a deprived socioeconomic situation, or they come from the inner city and what have you. But yet you had athletes from every background, and yet that was never a problem. Was that because you didn't look upon it as a problem, that that was something you had to solve and you just approached it head on?
Oh, I think very definitely so. You have to... they're just basketball players out there in relation with each other and trying to establish themselves. Your job is to try to make the best team out of them. There will be different races, different religions, and I don't think it's any different today than it was when I coached or before I coached.
When you were coaching, you had those superstars, and there were some who said that you protected them from the media. You didn't really give them full exposure to the media, that you kind of fed them along the way so that they could get used to it. Was there anything to that, John?
Only in their freshman year. Their freshman year, they were very, very closely watched, and we didn't like for them to have many interviews, and that was definitely set up through our sports athletic news bureau. After that, they were on their own as far as interviews and what it was going to, as long as it didn't interfere with practices or wasn't at a time on the game day when it would be interfere with their concentration on the game particular day. But otherwise, no, I had no restrictions on them at all.
Did it bother you to hear those type of criticisms of your style?
When you're in the public eye and you can't accept the criticisms, you better get out. It's the same thing as I tried to tell my players, that there'll be times that they're going to get criticism that's unjust, and they won't like it. And sometimes it'll be just. But also, I want them to always keep in mind that at times they're going to get praise that they really don't deserve, and other times they'll get praise they deserve. They'll like it either way. But you've got to take those in stride, and your ability to accept both criticism and praise, in my opinion, will determine what kind of a person you are. You let either one of them lose your perspective about either one, whether it's praise or criticism, it's going to hurt you from being able to function according to your particular level of competency.
One of the things that I've found in talking to your former players is that a lot of the things that they picked up, they always talk about what they learned while they were under you at UCLA and how it's carried over into other things in their life beyond their playing days.
Well, it should. Now, I've been asked many, many times, in athletics, build character. And my answer has always been the same as long as I can remember. I say it can build character, but it can also tear down character.
Mm-hmm.
It depends upon the leadership, and it's up to coaches to provide leadership. I've always taken great stock in something that I read in the NEA Journal back shortly after I entered the teaching profession in the middle 30s. I read something that said, no written word, no spoken plea can teach our youth what they should be, nor all the books on all the shelves. It's what the teachers are themselves. You have to teach, and you have to set the example if you expect the youngsters to execute the way that you would hope that they will be. Not in terms of being better than somebody else, but constantly making improvement toward becoming the best of which they're capable.
John Wooden has co-authored a brand new book called Be Quick, But Don't Hurry. Very interesting title, John. How'd you come upon this one?
Well, Andy, who's really responsible for this book and did it all, he remembered that in practice that's one of the things that they heard more than anything else is be quick, but don't hurry. I believe that's important. I didn't want activity without achievement, and I think when you hurry, you have activity, but you don't always get the achievement. But on the other hand, if you're not quick, you might not get to do things, whether it be playing basketball or driving the freeway or something else. You have to be quick, but you must never hurry. And Andy, years later, I began to realize that and some of the other things that I had tried to teach in basketball, he was actually teaching in a very successful profession where producing such things as Touched by an Angel and Dr. Gwen Medicine Woman and Walker Texas Ranger and some others.
He was a player for you back in the 70s, was he not?
Played on three national championship teams.
And was he, you know, he wasn't the type of guy that would stand out like some of the big names that you had, but what was his contribution on those teams?
Well, he didn't get to play a lot, that is true, but I'll tell you, some of those players never get appreciated by what they do in the development of those they're playing ahead of them. And I know he was unhappy about it, but I expect that. I expect players, I want them to play, but he was needed. Everyone is needed. There's a role for every one of them. That Andy was a very bright person, as it showed when he has done well in business when he got out of school, and we made connections a while back, and it's just been very nice.
What are those carryover lessons in basketball, in coaching, in teaching, in sports that have been able to be carried over into one's personal life? What can be transposed, John?
Well, certainly consideration for others. You have to do that. To have teamwork, we have to have consideration for others. And then the value of hard work and enjoying what you're doing. I think that that's important, that force yourself to work as hard as you should and to reach your own particular level of competency, you have to enjoy what you're doing. And I think these come out in sports, those things and plus the consideration for others. But there are other things to do, too, but I think those stand out.
You had a lot of great star players. You didn't like to have them be known as individual stars, but I'm wondering, there's been great debate in sport as to whether you treat stars on any player at any level differently than you do the regular player. What's your perspective on that, John?
Well, I never said, never promised players I'd treat them all alike. You're going to try to give each individual the treatment they earn and deserve. But you're imperfect, and you're going to be wrong at times, certainly. But if you're wrong too much, you know you won't be around very long. But I never wanted them to think they'd treat them all alike. I never wanted them to believe that I'd like them all the same. They wouldn't like each other all the same, and they wouldn't like me all the same. And I did hope that they would have respect for me, and I hope that they would grow to understand as time went by that I really loved them all, and I did. Regardless of whether those played a lot or those that didn't play so much. Some of them that I have the greatest affection for never played as much as some of the others.
How difficult is it to take a variety of talents and a variety of personalities and egos and blend them into one sophisticated operating unit like a basketball team?
I think that's one of the most difficult things that a teacher of any sport has to do, and that is to get them to work together for the welfare of the group as a whole. I have felt in watching Phil Jackson with the Lakers and formerly with the Bulls, his ability to get the other players to play their roles in order to help them have the best team, understanding that, for example, Shaquille and Kobe, they can't do without them, and they could be replaced much easier than Kobe or Shaquille could.